murmur of, the large murmur of the crowd behind me, I became happy that I had, so many people were following me in the congregational prayers. And this is wrong, it shouldn't matter to me whether one person prays behind me or millions of people pray behind me. If I'm doing it for God, it shouldn't make a difference. But if I'm doing it for the love of leadership, obviously it's going to affect me. Perhaps this is the reason why Imam Sadiq alayhi salam has been reported to having said, "One who seeks after leadership perishes. Man talaba riyasa halak." Somebody goes and actively pursues becoming a leader of people, he ends up perishing spiritually, maybe even in a worldly sense as well. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at the censure of the love of leadership in the words of Imam Baqir alayhi salam. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hussain Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Kavit Akhwai. When it comes to the UK, the headlines couldn't be worse, and in some cases, shocking. For example, UK Royal Mail workers and university lecturers begin fresh strike as inflation skyrockets. Or another headline, Britons turn to pet food amid cost of living crisis. Well, in this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether things are as dire in the UK as it seems to be, and as the headlines indicate, and whether the government headed by the multimillionaire Prime Minister Sunak's austerity budget can even come close to fixing the UK's economic crisis. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Saeed Mohsin Abbas joins us. He's a journalist and political commentator from London. Also joining us is Clive Menzies, researcher and political economy analyst, also joining us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. I'll first start with you, Clive Menzies. Taking a look at how things are in the UK, obviously the headlines paint a doomsday scenario, but as we keep getting news, it just seems like it's getting worse. For example, the latest being that things are likely to get worse before they get better. This comes from the Bank of England, which is why I'm introducing this to you in form of a question, where it says it's predicting a lengthy downturn. And in addition, Britain was the only group of seven economies yet to recover fully from the COVID slump. Are things as bad in the UK as the headlines are indicating?
Well, I think the question is phrased in terms of relative growth
by inference, saying that Britain is taking much longer to recover. But I think this is much less to do with competition between countries and much more to do with something far more overarching, which is essentially we've been predicting this collapse and hyperinflation for some years now because of the way in which central banks have been printing money like there's no tomorrow. And it's quite instructive that I think the alarm bells were ringing in the summer of 2019. Mark Carney, who was very much part of the architect of this crisis in waiting, resigned from the Bank of England on the 15th of March 2020 and gave a hospital pass to the rather intellectually challenged Andrew Bailey, who as recently as July 2022 was saying that our job is to keep inflation at 2% and that's what we'll do. Clearly, the Bank of England's economists, and more importantly, the governor of the Bank of England, hasn't a clue as to how this all came about. But those who were disinterested and not part of the club that are benefiting from what's been going on over the last 3 years could see this coming a mile off. In terms of how bad things are, we were predicting back in the summer that in the autumn things were going to get very bad. And we're going to go through a very deep economic crisis. But the good news is that increasingly there is visibility of the corruption and criminality, the amount of money that has been laundered, for want of a better way of putting it, through this manufactured COVID crisis, the climate narrative, which is also false and has been used under the cover of COVID to basically turn cities into ghost towns. I spent most of my time during the so-called pandemic moving around London as I normally would, and the place was deserted. So in terms of economic crisis, it's no wonder when they deliberately collapse the economy.
All right. Well, Seamus and Abbas, I don't know if you agree with what Clive Menzies there said, but one thing that caught my attention, I want to ask you, is that there was a certain class there that was aware that the UK economy will be at least facing the situation that it is, and it made off from this and profited from this. Because some things don't make sense, like the GDP of the UK registering at $3 trillion or over $3 trillion. But yet, you know, you're having what you're facing right now. So something maybe is not making sense. And, of course, there are guests also talking about how you know, it may be the rich that are really making out here, generally speaking. I mean, this figure in terms of the GDP and the fact that the UK is facing what it's facing really is, it points to a great economic inequality, which the UK has been plagued by.
Well, Britain is the biggest offshore tax haven, and it has the Corporation of London, the City Square Mile, which is one of the biggest money laundering, regions in the world. It acts essentially as a place where the rich and the powerful and the corporate sector hides its money, does its dirty deals. Most of it is beyond the law. In fact, that square mile has its own jurisdiction, everything from the Lord Mayor that presides over it through to their police there, through to whether the British government can even ask questions of those huge corporations and the huge amounts of money that pass through there. And London itself has become really, it's awash with dirty money from every corner of the world. And yet, at the same time, that same Corporation of London actually has probably 30%, if not more, Clive might correct me, of the hold on the GDP of this country. So they can switch off the button in Britain very, very easily if these huge players are upset in any way, or if the British government doesn't toe the line of the City of London. Westminster has far less power, I would really argue, than that corporation itself. So that's one thing. But that controlled demolition of the economy, which Clive certainly hinted at, if not started opening up on, you only have to look at the sequence of events. You know, when they first flooded Britain with migrant workers from Poland and from Europe, I mean, there was a huge sort of issue at the work front at that time. But then What they've gone and done is the Brexit thing. They've done the migrant restriction on labor. They've gone into this Ukraine war without thinking. They're part and parcel of the U.S. sanctions on Iran and other places, so they can't do business. Their own companies can't do business with major economic powerhouses around the world. The COVID overreaction and the way they dealt with that was diabolical in and of itself. And of course, the background to all this is the Great Reset, which we can't ignore. The context of all of this is that actually globally, this idea of digital money coming through, the idea of totalitarian economy, China style, if you like, the emergence of AI, there are a lot of things that the big, rich, and powerful money mafia, as I've described them, want to happen. And part of it is to really teach people a lesson, bring down their expectations, have them at each other's throat with economic worries while they get on quietly over the next 10 years, continuing to readjust the entire economic and political, if you like, landscape according to their requirements.
Okay, well, you just mentioned Brexit there amongst your statements, and I have to ask you, Clive Menzies, about what the British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, has said on trade. Let me be unequivocal about this. Under my leadership, the UK will not pursue any relationship with Europe that relies on alignment with the EU laws. He says, I voted for Brexit, I believe in it, and I know that Brexit can deliver. But Brexit has not delivered. So why is he beating the drums on something that seems to be a failed policy at this point?
Well, the whole Brexit debate is worthy of a program at least on its own, because there was no Brexit, there is no Brexit, there will never be any Brexit as long as this existing structure persists. What we had was all the things that were a matter of convenience for ordinary people like me to travel and to do business in other countries. Those have been restricted, but we are in lockstep with European policy on Ukraine, on finance, on law, on everything. So what Rishi Sunak is claiming is an outright inversion of reality. And this is a charade or pantomime that's been played ever since 2016, where I would have suggested in hindsight that the election of Trump and the referendum on Brexit were primarily to divide the 99% who were beginning to realize that we weren't run by governments and there was no political reality, that actually money power rules everything. And in order to fragment that coming together, if you like, both Trump and Brexit were very effective in dividing populations down the middle. But the reality is there is no Brexit. It's an illusion. And what Mosin was referring to in terms of this Great Reset, this is all in lockstep. Everything's happening together. So any pretense that, you know, we're not doing as Europe are doing, I mean, you only have to look at the Netherlands and the way they're closing down farming, and they're doing the same over here. This is a war on us all, and this is a war between centralized power, which is primarily, as Mosin says, in the hands of those who control money, and the rest of us. And most people are unaware that we're in this war, uh-huh. But increasingly I'm finding on the ground that more and more people are awakening to this. So their plans are not going to work, and that's good
key.
News that we can take away from this.
Exactly, and that's key, Said Mohsen Abbas. To put it into a couple words, people power. Taking a look at what the strikes are going on in the UK on a variety of sectors, the ambulance strike, we're looking at the UK Royal Mail workers, the university lecturers are the most recent strikes amongst a host of other sectors that have gone on a strike in the UK. Now, you know, these people are not, I mean, this is basically because of the inflation, their pay is not keeping up with it. So isn't the government worried about this? Or should I say, aren't the people in the higher echelons, the 1%, worried about the fact that people are going to turn against them?
Well, I imagine they are worried, but at the same time, there's one thing that you often see, that these folk who are at the in that upper echelon, they tend to profit whether there's chaos, conflict, war, or peace. They always seem to be in some way pulling the strings. One hopes that, as Clive in a lot of his research has put together, this notion of withdrawing consent. One hopes that if the public awakens and they withdraw consent from these exploitative, usurious, quite psychotic institutions and individuals that are in control, then there's hope. And of course, those people, if they did wake up to this reality, then what they're trying to implement on the ground, which is that in birthplaces like Burnley today, we've got 50% of children who are living in absolute poverty, according to certain definitions of poverty, which is, I think, below 60% of inflation-aligned median income. That was in 2010-11. But things like this, things like old people now having to turn off their heating, you know, skipping lunches, not having holidays anymore, having to spend their savings in feeding kids. These are all realities on the ground which are already hitting home. And if they carry on, then one hopes that people will dig deeper as to why this is all happening, and they will react and respond. And these strikes are no bad thing. This awakening of people in terms of realizing that the political economy is geared towards the billionaires, who we all know became, and it's all proved that they became hugely rich during COVID and post-COVID. So it does seem as though even now Rishi Sunak is taking it easy on those rich folk, because they're not, I mean, their tax reliefs, etc., are the caps are being taken off. They're allowed to sort of do what they like. And whilst they may be trying to soften the impact of energy prices, waking the people up and creating, huge problems for the government, it may not be enough. People may hopefully wake up and see that the actual systemic problems will not go away by trusting the established structural elite, as we often say.
You mentioned the town was Burnley, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Burnley. I'm going to ask you, Clive Menzies, when it comes to some of the testimonials here, because we have to cover this. Skipping lunch each day and watching TV in blankets to keep warm is not how this couple really imagined their retirement to be. Rationing cups of tea in the face of soaring energy bills, of which Burnley, happening in Burnley now, one of the most deprived areas in Britain, are spending more of their income on essential goods. It has seen the sharpest increases in prices than elsewhere. Are we looking at this as being the worst case scenario, just unique to this particular town, or is it widespread in the UK?
I'm sure that the people who have been playing by the rules of what Mosen described as the money mafia, because they set the rules. The whole economy is geared around harvesting people's energy and resources and whatever wealth they can accumulate. And basically, there will be a lot of people who will suffer as a result if they continue to play by the rules. But what is actually happening is that people are beginning to realize that things like council taxes, utility bills, and debt are optional as to whether you repay them, because the whole system has been created to harvest our energy and resources, and people are beginning to wake up to that. And I've not been able to verify this, but a sizable swathe of the population in the north of England has ceased paying their council taxes. And this is just the beginning. I won't go into the lawfulness of council tax, but it is unlawful, and more people are beginning to realize that. So there are many ways in which people are fighting back. And the way that people will be able to work through this and begin to thrive is by forming communities separate from the structures and the authorities that they live under. Because there is, an economic crisis doesn't destroy anything other than money. And money isn't worth anything. It's the food and all the infrastructure and all that we need to live on that is important. And people are forming their own groups and communities to provide healthcare, to resist the unlawful demands of the system, and to grow their own food. This is all beginning to happen. Food cooperatives, cutting out the retailers from eggs, for example. There are farmers who produce eggs, and the supermarkets play them so little that it's not worth their while to produce them. Well, now sure. Communities are forming to go direct to the farmers. So this system is going to be bypassed and it's going to collapse, but it's going to take time and there's going to be death and destruction in the meantime.
Well, I mean, it's getting pretty bad here, Seamus and Abbas, when you're having reports such as people resorting to eating pet food come out in the news and making the news. So it's got to be pretty bad at this point. Now, you're looking at the Chancellor of the Exchequer saying that poor households should be spared much of the pain and cuts to public services. But then you have the central government funding for Burnley, since we're talking about that town, to have fallen by £5 million a year since the year 2013 through 14. That's about a third. Now, if that's happening to the poorest of towns, then that's a pretty bleak picture. Does Rishi Sunak understand, or through his exchequer understand, the depth of desperation that towns like Burnley are in?
I think they fully understand. I think that they take their orders, as we say, from forces much higher than them. And once you have that scenario where Britain is having to go in line with the policies that are being set by corporate money mafias that are outside of Britain, and they are essentially usurping the British electorate's democratic, you know, rights, and they are usurping Britain's independence, economic independence and political independence, essentially. That's what they're doing. But it's all being done in an underhand way in the background. So the fact is that Rishi Sunak and these people and the government itself, I believe the civil service, I mean, they've been in this business for centuries. They know very well how things work and how the Treasury certainly isn't, you know, some would say they might be manned by half-wits, but I rather suspect that they do know, but they are under orders to run the policies that they are and have been. So the net result really is, you know, at the end of the day, you've got inflation 12% rising over the last year. And don't forget, the austerity that was going on during the Tory term over their term here has been ongoing already. And there were huge, before COVID, certainly, there were huge rallies that were picking up against the Tory austerity lie, as it were. And those are now obviously going to return, I think, in a much bigger way, one hopes. But what's more important is that people need to look more deeply about the elitist classes which have been constantly put back in power. If Starmer from the Labour Party comes into power, he's not any better. He's also beholden to exactly the same systemic corruption. And it's a nonsense that where these two-party systems in most of the democratic world try to fool people that in some way there is some choice, and they play this kind of good cop, bad cop, right. You know, austerity versus releasing the burden on the masses. This game has gone on long enough, and I think that people, it's high time people really woke up to the fact that there needs to be systemic deep change in the way we operate our political economies.
Okay. Well, both of you have mentioned this great reset. Now, I'm assuming the reset, Clive Menzies, is the one that the WEF put into motion, not put into motion, introduced or got some coverage that was of a major degree across the media, in a sense. Is that the great reset we're talking about, where it's to green energy? And my question, aside from that, is how the U.S. is playing a role in leading Europe down a path where it's actually affecting the industries and factories in Europe as a whole through its initiative, which is green in nature in terms of the Inflation Reduction Act, where companies from Europe are relocating to the U.S. Can you put that into the Great Reset scenario for us, if you can?
In a short time, that's quite difficult. But I think when Mosin talks about choice, the late great George Carlin, comedian, said, "It's a big club and you ain't in it. You don't have choice. You have owners." And essentially, the fact that, you know, we can refer to the U.S. and the U.S. and Europe having some sort of competition, and certainly with what's been happening with the sanctions in Russia, Europe has been sort of thrown in at the deep end, and it's going to suffer severely, and has been made to commit some sort of energetic or economic suicide as a result. So there is this inter-country competition, but this is universal. You know, the Americans are suffering, or will suffer, no less than Europeans and Brits and anybody else who's caught up in this great reset. But the Great Reset is about recasting the way in which the world works, because the game that has been played for centuries is that when, in order for economic growth, you go and plunder other countries. Well, all the countries have been plundered. There are now too many people, in their view. There aren't too many people if we had a rational economic system.
Right.
But in their view, because it's a hunger games economy where there are always more losers than winners, then they're resetting the turf, one, to reduce the population, and the green agenda is very much part of that. Net zero doesn't mean net zero carbon, and you know, we are carbon life forms. It means net zero people. In other words, let's reduce the number of people. So that's part of it. The other part of it is actually because there are more people than there are functional jobs to do, and there are many jobs that actually don't actually produce wealth, then it's about substituting, as Mosen said, AI and robotics for people.
Sure.
So this is all part of the Great Reset, but it's a big complex issue that needs much more time.
Definitely. What a bleak world we live in. Final question. Mohsen Abbas, looking up UK economic crisis through this software we have for news here, the thing that came up was how you have Britain's Prince William, Prince of Wales, and Catherine, Princess of Wales, arriving for the 2022 Earthshot Prize ceremony at the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library and Museum in Boston, Massachusetts. Now, you would think if the UK is mired in an economic crisis of this proportion that we just covered, it seems like the priorities are misappropriated when it comes to, let's say, the prince. Am I correct to put it that way? Less than a minute.
I think we can say that royalty is part of that elitist structure. They're the most visible, and they get easily, of course, targeted. But in reality, if you were to go to the clubs and private accommodations in Mayfair of most of this elitist mafia in London, they're not going to be affected by the bread prices and by the prices of milk going up the way they are. They're not going to be affected by energy or heating.
Okay.
They don't care. The reality is it's the poor man, it's the people on the ground that are suffering, and they need to really fight
with
the resistance economy. Globally, resistance economy, fighting the system in that way is necessary now.
Thank you so much. Sorry to cut you. We're just fresh out of time. Sam Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator, Clive Menzies, researcher and political economy analyst. Thank you to you both. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tapway and the team, it's goodbye.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, I'm Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll try to discuss the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم كذبت قوم نوح المرسلين
The people of Noah denied the messengers.
إذ قال لهم أخوهم نوح ألا تتقون
When their brother Noah said to them, Will you not fear Allah?
Dear listeners, brothers and sisters, as you were previously with us, we have reached the 106th verse of this chapter, Surah Al-Shu'ara. كَذَّبَتْ قَوْمُ نُوحٍ الْمُرْسَلِينَ إِذْ قَالَ لَهُمْ أَخُوهُمْ نُوحٍ أَلَا تَتَّقُونَ The people of Noah rejected the messengers when their brother Noah said to them, Will you not fear? Now we explained the story of Prophet Abraham, and prior to that, the story of Prophet Moses, and how the Holy Quran ended up telling us that these are the stories you need to understand, and through which you need to believe in the Lord of the worlds. And there is great sign in these stories. Now, the Holy Quran refers to this part of Noah's life, which is rather similar to what was formerly mentioned about the life of Moses and Abraham. So it says, إِذْ قَالَ لَهُمْ أَخُوهُمْ نُوحٍ Remember the time when their brother Noah said to them, Will you not fear? أَلَا تَتَّقُونَ Will you not fear Allah? Now, this is really interesting since the application of a brother أخوهم in this verse is a kind of sense which shows the ultimate affection relationship that is based upon equality. It means without intending to have any priority over them. Just like one of themselves, Prophet Noah invited them to piety. And this happened with utmost purity and sincerity. I mean, his behavior and his demeanor with and among the people was only based on this relationship with them. And he did not claim to be superior over them. He just tried to invite them as one of their brethren and brothers.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi
a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qum.
So the verse says, إِذْ قَالَ لَهُمْ أَخُوهُمْ نُوحْ أَلَا تَتَّقُونَ. When their brother Noah said to them, will you not fear Allah? This application of the word brother that we explained, the concept of brotherhood in this word not only has been used for Noah, but it also has been applied for many other prophets, such as Prophet Hud, Salih, and Lut. This inspires all the leaders of the path of the truth that they must observe the utmost love and sincerity in their call if they are to invite people to monotheism, when they are far from any self-superiority. This is the time that the annoyed hearts can be attracted by the religion. This is the time that no one feels heaviness. And this is the time that most of the people will kindly accept the invitation. And one of the other important things that can be understood from this word أخوه is that in order to be called one of the brothers of the people, you need to be in them, you need to live in them, you need to be aware of their own cultures, their language, their customs, their pros and cons, and all the aspects of their lives in order to be called a brother. That is why the invitation is based on this brotherhood. قَالَ لَهُمْ أَخُوهُمْ نُوحٌ. Only one can be called a brother to people who is aware of their thoughts, who is aware of their behaviors, their pros and cons, and whatever they are in need of. And the last point regarding this verse is that he called them to piety. أَلَا تَتَّقُونَ. Aren't you feared of the Almighty Allah? This means even if you are from the ones that are pious, even if you are from the ones that are truly believing in the monotheism, you do not need to stop. You have to start inviting others to monotheism and to piety as well. And this is one of your responsibilities, to try to guide the others. إِذْ قَالَ لَهُمْ أَخُوهُمْ نُوحْ أَلَا تَتَّقُونَ. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Things always work for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The repercussions of the war in Yemen and the difficult economic conditions continue to take a heavy toll on Yemeni patients. Yemen's Ministry of Public Health and Population held a press conference to shed light on the impact of the continued Saudi siege on thalassemia patients. Those suffering from this disease need to get blood transfusions every 3 weeks and must stay on medication for life.
Our main concern is the lack of medicines for thalassemia patients. These medicines, if available, are very expensive in addition to the lack of necessary medical examinations. We have 20,000 registered patients, while the real numbers are many times higher. These children need special medical care, and we hope that international organizations will stand by them by providing them with what they need.
The Yemeni Health Ministry has recorded nearly 500 deaths due to the lack of only one of the drugs used to treat thalassemia. The ones grappling with the disease seem to be losing hope as time goes by. With their health constantly deteriorating, they are desperately asking for help from international organizations, including the UN.
We suffer a lot from thalassemia. Medicines are not available. We need expensive medicines such as growth injections. We also suffer from a shortage of blood donors, which is what we need continuously.
We greatly need to be provided with important medicines that have not been available since the beginning of the war, such as iron withdrawal treatments. Because our iron level is high due to frequent blood transfusions, which also causes frequent infections.
Saudi Arabia's siege on Yemen and the ensuing shortages of food and medicine is putting more lives at risk every day. The healthcare system is feeling a massive strain, and the international community has yet to take any definitive steps towards ending the crisis here. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The Italian government has been authorized to send, when it sees fit, military assets, materials and equipment to Ukraine until December 31st next year. The go-ahead has arrived from Italy's lower house, the Chamber of Deputies, which has passed a motion presented by the right-leaning parties backing the government coalition and supported by some opposition groups, including centre-left Democratic Party and centrist Italia Viva Azione. Italy has so far classified the arms it has been sending to Ukraine, but some media have suggested the next package will likely include air and missile defense.
9 months after the start of the conflict, sending weapons to Ukraine is no longer the way to go. We must put peace talks on the table and work all together for a UN-backed peace conference promoted by the EU.
Support for Ukraine has been a contentious issue within the ruling coalition, with Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni positioning herself as a staunch supporter of Kiev. However, her partners Matteo Salvini and Silvio Berlusconi, respectively leaders of the League and Forza Italia parties, have been so far much more ambiguous due to their historical ties with Moscow and President Vladimir Putin. The two have repeatedly stressed the urgency of stepping up efforts to promote peace negotiations.
Giorgia Meloni is firmly and strongly linked or attached to the partnership and the alliance with the United States and with NATO. So I don't think she will do something to promote compromises or peaceful or diplomatic solution.
NATO's Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has recently said, quote, "The Western alliance intends to keep fighting for Ukraine until it wins back all the territory Russia has seized since 2014. However, there seems to be an open wedge between the parliament and the Italian people. Latest polls show that more than half of Italians advocate for peace negotiations between Russia and Ukraine, and only a third are okay with a country sending more weapons to Kiev.
Peace talks must be started now. They have to find a solution to end this war. This situation is dangerously taking us toward a brink.
We are being run by governments of weaklings in the pocket of NATO, and the Meloni government is no different. Our constitution clearly says Italy rejects war.
It's not anymore a war between Russia and Ukraine. It's about all of us. We begin to feel exhausted.
The approval of the motion in the lower house on supplying weapons to Ukraine also included a provision which increases military spending to 2% of GDP by 2028, as required by NATO. The motion is currently under discussion at the upper house. The Senate will have the final say on the matter. Max Civili, Rome.
Pakistan has hosted a dialogue platform for the OIC member states to boost cooperation among them in the field of science and technology. Senior officials representing Iran, Kazakhstan, Tunisia, Qatar, Malaysia, Indonesia, and Pakistan attended the meeting, while Saudi Arabia, Morocco, Turkey, Azerbaijan, United Arab Emirates, and Cameroon participated via video conference. The first senior officials meeting of the OIC Forum was aimed at strengthening scientific cooperation and to encouraging major technological initiatives.
This forum provides us opportunities of bilateral, multilateral cooperation. So one or two or several countries can work together. With Iran, of course, we have a very strong cultural, historical, and scientific collaboration. And of course, Pakistan and Iran can work together.
Iran's Deputy Science Minister Peyman Salehi told the meeting that OIC was established to strengthen unity and collaboration among Islamic countries. He offered the participants Iran's cooperation in the field of science and technology.
This collaboration between 15 countries may have a very fruitful outcome in near future. Therefore, we arranged for the first meeting of ministers that will be held, I think, about 4 to 6 months later.
The Iranian minister further said that despite the sanctions imposed by the West, Iran is self-sufficient in the field of science and technology and has invested big in its infrastructure and commercialization of technology.
In 2021, Iranian scientists published about 78,000 papers, peer-reviewed papers in international journals, and at the moment we are in the rank 15 in the world. We have established about 50 science and technology parks in Iran, more than 240 incubators, and so on.
Participants in the meeting discussed in detail the objectives, terms of reference, and working procedures of the OIC 15 and recommended them for adoption by the ministerial committee, which is scheduled to be held in the near future.
The presence of Iranian officials in the OIC meeting shows that Iran is not dependent on the East or the West, and it's ready to boost its political and scientific cooperation with various countries across the globe. Nasser Kazmi in Islamabad.
South Korea's container and cement truck drivers are out in the cold, on strike with no extension to an agreement they say ensures safe cargo transportation and livable incomes. The union also wants tanker trucks, auto carriers, and delivery vehicles included in their deal. The strike action has widened to Seoul Metro Subway, with other transportation workers also threatening walkouts.
Believing in the government's commitment to the constitution and expansion of the safe freight system, we held off the strike and waited. But the system expires in a month, and the government's promise has not been kept. So we had no choice but to bring out our last card, the strike card.
Slowdown in construction and cargo delivery has already caused hundreds of millions in damages each day, with 5,000 truckers off the job. The slowdowns are rippling through South Korea's export-led economy as the strike enters its second week. President Yoon Suk-yeol this week ordered cement truck drivers back to work, with construction companies reporting losses into the tens of millions of dollars.
The foundation of our industries is in danger of being devastated. Even people's daily lives are being threatened. There is no way to justify the act of taking the lives of people and the national economy hostage to accomplish their own interest.
The Yoon administration has vowed to deal sternly with the illegal strike action.
The truckers were on strike just 5 months ago, but that strike only ended with the extension of the safe trucking freight rate system through the end of this year. With the government's back-to-work order, the truckers are threatened with fines and even jail sentences for those refusing to get back behind the wheel. Frank Smith, Wee Wang, South Korea.
Yemen is on the road to achieving self-sufficiency, with government plans and strategies aimed at doubling and expanding Yemeni agriculture and local food production. On this trip to a Yemeni farmland, I am accompanied by Wajih Al-Mutawakkil. The man is in charge of vegetable production in Yemen. Al-Mutawakkil is one of the government officials leading the campaign to revive Yemen's rich agriculture. He is here to show us the agricultural projects the government is funding.
We are now on the outskirts of Sana'a, right behind Sana'a International Airport, and beyond this point is where Yemen's agricultural renaissance is beginning to take place. Here, there's farmers that are planting crops such as garlic, onions, barley, and wheat. And these are crops that are vital to keeping the Yemeni economy afloat and keeping Yemenis from going hungry during this strangling economic blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia.
One of the ways to counter food shortage in Yemen is through the launch of water-based greenhouse projects.
These are the greenhouse projects we launched. There are about 8 on this farm. These are water-based greenhouse, which means we plant crops using gravel instead of soil. This gravel is extracted from the Yemeni mountains. This greenhouse project is made up of organic natural materials found only in Yemen.
Outside of these gas houses is an even more vital crop being harvested in acres of land that stretch beyond the horizon. Yemeni wheat. According to the Ministry of Agriculture, Yemen imports an estimated 4 million tons of wheat a year from foreign countries. To achieve self-sufficiency status, Yemen must produce its own wheat in order to eliminate its dependency on foreign imports. Farmers on the outskirts of the Yemeni capital are answering the call to produce more wheat.
This portion of the wheat is ready to be reaped, while the rest of the field is going to take another week to a week and a half before it is ready.
I like to take the wheat and grind it with my hands. Then I blow away the flax, and now it's ready for consumption.
As food production increases, many organizations have been formed to help achieve food security. Huan Foundation for Development in Agriculture is one of them. Huan Foundation educates Yemenis on the importance of helping the advance of the nation through agricultural initiatives. Huan also specializes in the production of basic foods from a combination of Yemeni seeds and grains at their local factory. They have even started their own brand of flour and healthy snacks sold in and out of the country. Huan's president believes that Yemen's high-quality agriculture must be revived in order to provide healthy food options for Yemenis and to eradicate some of the diseases caused by imported foods.
International organizations are playing and have played a large role in destroying Yemeni agriculture. They did so by exporting grain and wheat to us, which is often rotten and contains harmful substances like chemicals. Additionally, these grain shipments that enter Yemen have passed their expiration date, which results in a lot of illnesses.
After the revolution of September 21st in 2014, achieving self-sufficiency in Yemen is no longer an impossible task. According to Yemen's Ministry of Agriculture, if local food production continues to increase, Yemen could reach food security in just a few years.
The revolution against Western hegemony in Yemen was a starting point towards achieving self-sufficiency, which according to the Ansarullah leader is essential in order to secure food provisions for Yemenis. Yusuf Maudi, the outskirts of the Yemeni capital.
At
Chile has fallen on relations between Moscow and the Vatican City. The rift has been sparked by an interview published in a U.S. magazine on Monday in which the head of the Catholic Church, Pope Francis, condemned, quote, the cruelty of some minority groups of soldiers, namely the Chechens and the Siberian Buryats, in the Ukraine's conflict. On Tuesday, Moscow's ambassador to the Vatican, Alexander Avdiiv, lodged an official complaint in response. Pope Francis' remarks were made during an interview with America, a Jesuit magazine headquartered in New York. When asked about his apparent reluctance to directly condemn Russia for the war in Ukraine, the pontiff said in response that he received much information about the cruelty of the troops. The Russian ambassador to the Holy See, Avdiiv, expressed anger at the pontiff's, quote, insinuation of alleged atrocities by the Russian military during the course of the special military operation in Ukraine. The ambassador also stressed that nothing can shake the cohesion and unity of the multinational Russian people. The Russian Foreign Ministry also dismissed Pope Francis' comments.
What will the Vatican tell us about the martyrdom of the multinational Soviet people? Maybe it makes sense to first discuss Catholic penance for the 20th century for the Orthodox and for Muslims for the many centuries before that. This is no longer Russophobia. It's a perversion of the truth on a level I can't even name.
Earlier this week, Moscow had welcomed the Vatican's announcement of mediation to bring an end to the Russian-Ukrainian war. Some fear that this could no longer be viable after this diplomatic incident.
Però questo momento di tensione...
I don't think this tense moment will change the Vatican-Russia relations substantially. Moscow still expects the Holy See to position itself as a mediator in the conflict with Ukraine. But whether the mediation takes off will very much depend on Kiev and largely on the U.S.
On Sunday, top Vatican diplomat Archbishop Paul Richard Gallagher had said the Holy See and Pope Francis are ready to provide space for peace negotiations on Ukraine. However, after the announcement, Moscow said Kiev is against any peace talks. Max Civili, Rome.
In the United States, many spent their Thanksgiving holiday not in gratitude, but in grief, as mass shootings and violent crime continue to plague the nation. Many are lost in confusion, trying to explain why there have been over 600 mass shootings so far this year, a pace just below the all-time record. In only Chicago, the nation's third largest city, 8 people were killed and at least 30 wounded by gun violence over the holiday weekend.
Everybody's always talking about how dangerous this city is, how unreasonable it is to live in America because of how much crime there is. Crime rates are actually about the same. What changes is how much funding are we getting? How many schools are closing? How many resources do people have? And when you actually don't actually invest in this with a growing population, that's of course going to cause more crime.
The Democratic Party is about to hand over control of the House of Representatives, and they are being widely criticized for refusing to pass stricter gun laws when they had the chance. Republicans are likely to defend gun ownership, and they eked out a midterm legislative victory with a major emphasis on violent crime.
No matter what grievances you bring up, no matter what facts you throw at any congressperson, Democratic or Republican, right, their idea is to fund the police more. But this is money that should be going to the public. This is like, for example, here in Chicago in 2020, the mayor asked the public, like, hey, how would you like to sort the budget out? And 80% of the people voted that, hey, we should defund the police and put that money back into other things that could really help out the community.
Crime data in the United States is often late or unreported, but what is certain is that since the coronavirus lockdowns, murders have increased by at least 30%. But what statistics cannot capture is the widespread sentiment that the violence in today's United States is more brutal, shocking, and random than it was in years past. While the U.S. is by far the most armed nation per capita, other countries have high rates of gun ownership, but not the regular violence which makes American life uniquely precarious and fearful. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. Allah.